Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The statistics of evictions in the U.S. are stunning. Today, the majority of poor families in the U.S. who rent housing spend more than half of their income to do so. At least one in four of them spends more than 70% of their income to pay the rent and utilities. Many live without regular access to electricity or water. Even back during the Great Depression, evictions were rare. Now they are common. Harvard sociologist Matthew Desmond has written a new book on the topic. It is entitled Evicted: Poverty and Profit in the American City. Matthew Desmond joins us by phone from Boston today. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You wrote in the prologue something that really stuck with me. It was the last two sentences. You said, not everyone living in a distressed neighborhood is associated with gang members, parole officers, employers, social workers, or pastors, but nearly all of them have a landlord. And that just became this new common denominator for me that I hadn't really thought about before.
Yeah, I think a lot of us haven't thought about the role that housing is playing in deepening poverty in America and considered this really old and complicated and fraught relationship that between landlords and tenants. But it's absolutely central. You know, landlords literally own poor neighborhoods. They can dictate which family gets evicted and which gets to stay. They can tell you where you can live and who you can live with. They have a lot of power in low-income communities. And I think that what I really tried to do in my book, Evicted, was to understand not only the perspectives of tenants, but also the perspectives of landlords.
Right. What occurred to you to choose to include landlords in the stories in this book?
I'd always been, troubled by how much poverty we have in America. You know, America is unique among all rich democracies for the depth an expanse of its poverty, and I wanted to know the role that housing played in that. You know, I wanted to know the role that the private rental market, especially where the most of our poor renting families live, what role that plays in deepening inequality today. And I knew to really understand that, to really get my hand around the housing market and how it works and its inner dynamics, I needed to understand what makes landlords tick, why they own property in some of the worst neighborhoods, why they evict me but not you, and just kind of like their whole their business model.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the epidemic of evictions in the United States, and not just the epidemic and the occurrence of it, but what are the long-term and short-term ramifications of it. My guest is Matthew Desmond. He is a Harvard sociologist and the author of a new book. It's entitled Evicted: Poverty and Profit in the American City. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you want, you can check out our Facebook page and post a question or comment there. The images from that you share with us from your year-plus in Milwaukee researching for this book are almost Dickensian to me.
There is a lot of suffering happening in our poor neighborhoods today. And a lot of that suffering is caused by the fact that it's become harder and harder to pay for a roof over your head. And I remember going out with the sheriff eviction squad and seeing families evicted when it's very cold, a very cold, 40 below with the wind chill, 20 below with the wind chill in Milwaukee. I remember an eviction where the sheriffs evicted a house of children. The mom had died, and the kids had just gone on living there.
Yeah.
And, I think that for us to really understand our country and what we've allowed it to become, we do have to take a hard look at the lives of very poor families today. And Evicted does, but it also, I hope, chronicles humor and brilliance and spunk and generosity in the face of adversity, too. Those stories are in there as well because they reminded me how gracefully families, refuse to be reduced to their hardships.
You use the phrase that we've let our country become. Even during the Great Depression, the issue of evictions wasn't what it is today.
That's right. When you read stories or scenes of evictions from the Great Depression or the 1930s, you are left with a very clear image that they were rare and they were scandalous. You know, they used to draw crowds. People used to protest them. The New York Times wrote about an eviction of just three families in the Bronx in the early 1930s, and it reported on that scene by saying, because of the cold, only 1,000 people showed up to protest. Mm-hmm. You know, it was kind of a... But now we've reached a point where evictions have become rare. And if we live in poor neighborhoods, we've grown used to the rumble of the moving truck through our streets and the early morning knocks. In Milwaukee, the city that I studied, one in eight renters in the city of Milwaukee is evicted every 2 years. That counts formal evictions that go through the court and informal evictions that don't. That's an incredible amount of instability. Now, is it like that in Cleveland and Columbus and San Francisco? We've crunched the numbers in other places, including Cleveland and Chicago, Kansas City. New York City sees 60 Marshall evictions every single day. In the national data that we have, we know that renters living in 2.8 million homes think that they'll be evicted soon. So eviction is quite an epidemic. It's at epidemic rates today, and it's moved from something that was rare and weird to us to something that's kind of become a defining feature of poverty in America.
For a lot of law enforcement people, this isn't what they got into that business for.
No, I don't think so. You know, I don't think kids say, you know, I want to go grow up and be a police officer or a sheriff's officer to move families out. But today we do have sheriff departments who's have full-time eviction squads, you know, who are carrying out eviction and foreclosure orders all day. You know, we have moving companies that specialize in evictions. We have data mining companies, hundreds of them, that collect eviction records and sell them to landlords and property managers. And so there has been a kind of an apparatus and another business that's grown up around this deep social problem, too.
And a lot of problems. I can't tell you how many times I have to say when I was reading the book, it made me think about my life as a journalist and how many times when I was reporting on education issues in low-income school districts, how just I blithely, you know, referred to the high mobility rate of the students without drilling down into, well, why is there this high mobility rate?
Yeah. You're not alone, you know, and folks that are poverty researchers and journalists and policymakers, we have used that language before, high mobility rates, high rates of residential instability among low-income families without knowing why. And what I think this research really clearly shows is families are moving so much because they have to. They're forced to. They can't afford to hold on to their homes for a large amount of time. There's nothing inherently unstable about poverty. You know, people aren't moving because of some other reason. They're moving a lot because they're just evicted from one place to the next. We have statistical data that shows that if you kind of take out evictions, poor folks don't move more than middle-class folks or affluent folks. So I think that if we want more stability, which is really necessary for kids and communities, now we need fewer evictions.
How many children are involved? Do you know? Have you seen statistics on that?
The face of America's eviction epidemic belongs to mothers and children. And if you go into the housing court in Columbus or Cleveland or any other housing court in urban America, you just see kids. You see kids running around. Most homes in Milwaukee that are evicted have children living in them. Until very recently, the Bronx Housing Court in New York City had a daycare because there were so many kids coming through its doors. And when I started this project, I thought that surely kids would kind of shield families from eviction. There would be some extra protection available to families with children. But what I learned is that children often expose families to eviction. If you look at everyone that goes to Milwaukee Eviction Court, for example, and you ask, why do you get evicted, but I don't, you know, when we both end up in housing court, the main reason is kids. If you live with kids, your chances of receiving an eviction judgment triple, even if you control for things like how much you owe a landlord. And what you're seeing in that finding is landlords deciding not to work with families with kids. And the landlords that I talked to, anyways, were pretty frank about kids, you know, hurting their bottom line. You know, kids cause property damage. They can test positive for lead poisoning. They can be harder on the house. They can be noisier. And so if you can choose between housing a family with kids and one without it, some landlords choose consciously or unconsciously to work with folks that don't have kids.
You contrast the need for shelter with food and health care. Now, we've got WIC, we've got food stamps or whatever the equivalent of that, whatever euphemism that might have now, and SNAP, and also we have health care. You know, we've expanded Medicaid in the state of Ohio along with Obamacare. These two things we think, yeah, you need decent health care and you need food. Shelter, not so much.
I think that most Americans still kind of assume that the typical low-income family lives in public housing or gets some sort of benefit from the government when it comes to affording their house. But the opposite is true. Only about 1 in 4 of all families that qualify for any kind of housing assistance receive anything. And the waiting list for public housing in some of our larger cities is not counted in years, it's counted in decades. So a single parent out there that applied for public housing in Washington, D.C., for example, might be a grandparent by the time his or her application gets reviewed. So, you know, under those circumstances, you know, paying 50, 60, 70% of your income on housing has become a reality, not for just a small slice of poor families, but for the majority of poor renting families. And so what do we do about that? What do we do about that? And I think that one way to answer that question is to ask another, which is, do we believe that housing is a right? Do we believe that stable, affordable shelter is part of what it means to be an American? And I think we have to answer yes, because without stable shelter, everything else falls apart.
You were surprised, you said in your book, and I was surprised to read you say this, that there aren't studies about the causes and consequences of eviction.
Yeah, it surprised me too. You know, and I started this work the old-fashioned way. I moved into a trailer park, and I lived there for several months, and then I moved into a rooming house in the inner city of Milwaukee, and I lived there for about 9 months. And, you know, from those two neighborhoods met families going through an eviction and landlords doing the evicting. And I, you know, but I was confronted as I was going through my kind of daily reporting by just basic questions, you know, like how often does eviction happen? What are the long-term consequences of it? And I thought surely someone else had collected this information and data, but I just didn't find anything. And one reason is because we'd spent a lot of time researching and writing on public housing, which is important, but houses, you know, a small minority of poor families today. And we've also thought a lot about neighborhoods, you know, things like concentrated disadvantage, crime rates in neighborhoods, also very important. But here was like the private rental market consuming most of the incomes of the families that I was spending time with, destabilizing entire communities, and we just didn't know much about it. So I decided to collect that data myself. We ended up surveying over 1,000 renters in Milwaukee. I analyzed hundreds of thousands of eviction records. We talked to over 200 people right in eviction court, and I tried to take all that statistical data and put it in concert with the narratives and the stories that I was collecting on the ground level.
We'll talk about some of those stories when we return. We're talking about the epidemic of evictions in the United States. My guest is Matthew Desmond. He's a Harvard sociologist and the author of the new book, Evicted: Poverty and Profit in the American City. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Rental housing is more expensive than ever. Wages are low or stagnated or non-existent for the largest group of people who depend on rental housing in America, the poor. Still with us by phone is Harvard sociologist and author Matthew Desmond. His new book is entitled Evicted: Poverty and Profit in the American City. Matthew, you wrote that since 1970, the number of people primarily employed as property managers had more than quadrupled. What's the math behind this? Why is that?
Well, I think that one thing that I learned is that property management, even in very low-income neighborhoods, can be quite lucrative. When I started this work, I wondered, gosh, you know, why would someone buy and rent out property in some of our most distressed areas?
Yeah.
And when I ended the project, I thought, why wouldn't you? Because the profit margins are there. So one of the landlords that I profile in the book is named Sharina. And she, you know, owned 36 units, all of them in the inner city. She hadn't been a landlord for very long when I met her, only 4 years. And she netted about $10,000 a month. She made a decent living. And that amount, her monthly income, exceeded the yearly income for a lot of her tenants who are working minimum wage or receiving disability. I think that's just a fact that we need to kind of consider when we're addressing these issues.
Right. She and she was an interesting character. I was fascinated by her. She didn't just happen into the business. She decided to specialize in renting to Black poor. A lot of the people might wonder about the advantages of that. So tell us, how does she rake in $10,000 a month? How does it work?
Right. So she kind of figured out that what makes owning property in the inner city a risky investment makes renting that property potentially a lucrative one. So you can buy property for on the cheap. That means your mortgage bill is cheaper, your tax bill is cheaper, and the rent is lower too. But it's not as much as lower. It's not as low as we think. And so rent in some of the poorest neighborhoods in Milwaukee for a two-bedroom apartment, for example, is only $50 less than the citywide median. And so you have an opportunity to buy property pretty low, but rent it at decent amounts. And so you can kind of garner quick and healthy returns on your investment if you have a stomach for the job. You know, and the book works really hard to complicate the tenant and landlord relationship. Mm-hmm. I think that we do let ourselves off the hook a bit if we say, oh, these tenants, they're so responsible, or, you know, we put it all on the landlords and say, oh, these guys are so greedy. I think when you look it in the face, it's a much more complicated story. Sharina's job wasn't easy, but she also knew how to make the business work.
One of the things that struck me was that people are desperate for a place to live. They'll do anything for a place to live. You wrote in detail about a fellow, his name is Lamar. Of course, you changed all the names to protect their identities and their privacy. But Lamar, tell us about Lamar and how much he struggled to give a home for his boys and a place to go for a lot of other kids.
Yeah, so Lamar was this gregarious, funny, whip-smart single dad. And he was trying to raise two teenage boys in the inner city. And his place was like, it's like the house that all the boys went to, you know, after school. It was a place where you could go and you could play cards and you can joke around a bit and you had a safe environment to talk about things like, you know, girls and school and the police. He was a really stabilizing presence in the neighborhood, but he fell behind. Lamar didn't have a lot of money. He was wheelchair bound. And at the time he was receiving welfare. He was trying to receive disability. He was a double amputee when I met him, and he fell behind in rent and tried to work off the rent with his landlord. You know, he painted a big apartment for her and tried to kind of get back in the black by putting in some labor. It turned out to be some free labor for Lamar. Sharina was his landlord, and she didn't think, you know, his painting job was up to snuff, and eventually move forward with an eviction for him. I think that in Lamar's story, there's a lot of take-homes for me, but one take-home is that, you know, eviction doesn't just affect a person or a family. It can affect an entire community, you know? So, you know, if Lamar was evicted, that neighborhood loses a stabilizing presence. It loses someone that can help make the neighborhood safer and better, and that should concern us as we think about how we can design policies to improve community stabilization and revitalization. Housing has to be central to that.
You know, obviously there are policies out there because there are programs for some people, as you mentioned earlier, just a very, very small fraction of the people who need help get help. So where are the policies falling short?
So the good news is we've made a lot of progress with housing over the generations. And if you look, you know, just back a few generations, there were slums teeming in our cities, and poor folks were living in housing with no heat and no running water, and there were outhouses in the middle of Philadelphia. We took on a battle with the slums, and we won. And I will be the first to admit that we still have a long way to go. You know, when I was living in the trailer park, for the most of the time, my trailer didn't have any water, hot water, even though I told the landlord, like, look, I'm a rider, I'm going to be writing about you and your trailer park. So imagine what my neighbors had to go through. But we've made huge progress on that, on housing quality. And the other good news is, you know, there's organizations all around the country working really hard to decrease family homelessness and preserve affordable housing. And one thing I've done around the publication of the book is start an organization called Just Shelter. And if you're in Columbus or Cleveland or Cincinnati, you can go to this website, justshelter.org, and find the organizations that are working really hard in your community on these very issues. But the bigger picture is just about the waiting list. You know, the bigger picture nationwide is that we as a nation haven't invested enough in providing affordable housing to meet the massive need. We have programs that work. You know, one of the programs that work really well is the housing voucher program. So under this program, if you receive a voucher, you could take that voucher and live anywhere you want as long as your housing isn't too expensive or too run down. And instead of paying 60%, 80% of your income on rent, you'd pay about 30%. You know, that program lifts millions of families above the poverty line every year. We know that after years and years on the waiting list, families do one consistent thing when they finally receive a voucher with their freed-up income. They go to the grocery store. They go to the grocery store. They buy more food. Their kids become stronger and less anemic. But the kids of most poor-renting families in the United States today aren't getting enough to eat because the rent eats first. We can do a much better job with this.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the epidemic of evictions in this country and what the ramifications are going forward. My guest is Matthew Desmond. He's a Harvard sociologist and the author of the new book, Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. If you have a question, if you have a comment, if you relate to some of the things that Matthew Desmond is talking about, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Anthony in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Anthony.
I'm calling from the Cincinnati area, or more precisely the Hillsborough area.
Okay, well, that's fine. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
My comment is that I want to preface it by saying I'm not xenophobic in the least, but I haven't heard anything mentioned about the influx of immigrants. I just watched a documentary 3-4 nights ago about if Cuban immigrants can get across the Mexican border, they're in free for all kinds of benefits. And you know, I'm not against helping people. I help people when I can. But our own native-born citizens are suffering, and there is a severe housing shortage. I just lived in motels for 2 years while I could find an apartment. And it was costing me $800 a month, and I only get $700 on disability. And if I hadn't had a kindly friend, I would be dead because I was going to commit suicide.
Okay, well, I'm glad you didn't. And hang on, Anthony. I mean, what is there, Matthew Desmond, a shortage of housing?
In some cities, there certainly is. You know, in tight rental markets, we are seeing the need for just more housing, and especially affordable housing. But in a lot of areas in the country, especially the Rust Belt, where you are, we see a lot of vacancies, vacancy rates in the double digits. But we also see relatively high rents, especially compared to the incomes of low-income families. I think that the bigger picture, I mean, we have to focus on the main causes of this, and immigrants aren't the cause. They're not the cause. What the cause is that incomes for folks, especially folks that don't have college degrees, have fallen or flatlined over the last two decades. Housing costs have soared all over the country. They soared in cities with heavy immigrant populations. They've soared in cities with low immigrant populations. They've soared everywhere around the country. And federal policy has not been rolled out to bridge the gap. Those are the three ingredients to this problem.
Scott in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Scott.
Hi. I had a question for the guest. I live here in Columbus, but I relocated from just outside of Milwaukee, and I still own a rental property there, a duplex in Wauwatosa. This is more middle class, but I do a lot of work on the front end to make sure that my tenants can afford the place that they're living in. I do checks on their income and things like that. And I was wondering if you could comment on where you think the line is between the responsibility of landlords and tenants to make sure that the people renting these places can afford them.
Yeah, that's a good question. And landlords have to be part of our conversations when we're thinking about this issue. You know, if we're going to house most of our low-income families in the private rental market, landlords absolutely have to be at the table. I think the model for providing rental housing in places like Wauwatosa, which is a pretty affluent suburb of Milwaukee, is different than the business model of providing housing in the inner city or very poor neighborhoods like trailer parks. And I think that landlords there have a trade-off. And the trade-off is kind of between asking for rent that's higher than people can pay, but getting not always the rent, but often kind of a pass on utilities and maintenance. So let me just kind of explain that. So a landlord like Sharina kind of asks for, you know, first month's rent, last month's rent, security deposit when you move in, just like a lot of other landlords do. But if you're a tenant that's paying 70 or 80% of your income to rent, that's impossible. So you move in kind of behind in day one. What you get is a house if you're that tenant. And what Sharina gets, and landlords in inner city often get, is kind of a pass on maintenance. You know, Sharina would say, you know, I'll work with you, you work with me. And so a tenant could call a building inspector if there's housing problems, or, you know, even withhold rent if there's certain housing problems, but not if that tenant's behind. If the tenant's behind, legal protections to kind of like prevent exposure to indecent and sometimes harmful housing issues go away. Not because it's legal to retaliate against those tenants, but because it's legal to evict the tenant at any time for being behind. So I know that was kind of like a windy road to the question, but I think the bottom line is the business model in more affluent or middle-class neighborhoods for landlords is different than the business model in the inner city. And I think that we need to focus both on the role that landlords can play in this and the role that tenants can play.
Let's hear from a landlord now. Jesse in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Jesse.
It's Jeff. Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I'm a landlord in Columbus, like you just said. I've got an elderly tenant. Her husband passed away a few years ago, and she has run out of money. She's run out of savings. I don't want to evict her, but I can't afford to just lose rent in perpetuity. So how can I help her?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I'm so glad you're asking that question. I think, you know, there's a specific answer, and then there's, I think, a larger perspective. I think the specific answer is, you know, there might be organizations in your city that are available for some sort of emergency assistance. There might be organizations that allow her to transition into elderly housing, which would be subsidized housing in the community, if she's willing to go in there. And one thing that you could do is you could go to the website that I just mentioned, justshelter.org, and see which organizations in your city are relevant to this and are working on this and doing things like this. I think that's the specific response. The larger response is, you know, there's a lot of people out there like Jeff that they don't want to evict their tenants. Eviction doesn't only have a consequence on the tenants, but landlords incur a cost too, not only financially, but also emotionally. You know, there's a prick that you feel, especially when you're connected to tenants. And I think that those kind of situations speak to this larger issue that, you know, we are in this situation today where so many Americans, millions of Americans, families just can't afford a roof over their head. And we need a serious kind of intervention to prevent people like Jeff from facing this really terrible decision and prevent, you know, folks like Jeff's tenants from, you know, facing homelessness in their silver years. You know, that's not right. We're better than this. We could do better than this.
Jess, thanks for that call. We appreciate it. Again, that website that Matthew Desmond just referred to is justshelter.org. We'll put that on our website at WOSU.org. So check that out. And let's see. Greg in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Greg. Oops, our phones have gone crazy, so we can't take that call. Sorry about that. 614-292-8513. If you want to give us a call, we'll get to it later. If you have want to check out an email address, check our email address. It's allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Matthew Desmond, why did you pick Milwaukee?
I think that the story, well, first of all, I love the Rust Belt. I feel so at home in cities like Milwaukee.
Did you grow up in a place like that?
No, I grew up in like a small town in Arizona. But
okay.
There's something about the Rust Belt that really, I don't know, I connect to, and I feel comfortable in those cities. So there's that. And but then there's a more intellectual reason too. And I think the story of the American city is being written on the margins. You know, we write a lot about places like New York or San Francisco, cities that we think are our biggest successes, and we write a lot about cities like Detroit, cities that a lot of people think are our biggest failures. But if you write about Milwaukee, which is somewhere in the middle, you have a shot at representing.
Okay, we'll take a break right now. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. The price of renting a home continues to grow across the country, including in Ohio, where housing is still unaffordable for many low-income families. Still with us by phone is Harvard sociologist and author Matthew Desmond. His new book is entitled Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. He will be speaking in Columbus coming up next in April. If you want more information on that, go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Joining us now is the Executive Director of the Coalition on Homelessness and Housing in Ohio, Bill Faith. Bill, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Ann. It's great to be here.
What Matthew Desmond is saying, all of this, is there an echo of it, as I suggested, you agree, in Ohio?
Oh, absolutely. It's actually, to have a Harvard sociologist get down into the trenches and look at this issue is really amazing. His perspective really brings to life the struggle that people have. It really brings to life. You feel like you're sitting in people's living rooms watching their life unfold when you're reading the book.
Right.
But it's about a huge problem that we've faced in Ohio and around the country for a long time. And I think we're seeing the consequences of neglecting available policy options that we've neglected really for decades in when it comes to access to affordable housing. So, you know, I was talking to the Columbus Metropolitan Housing Authority, which is the local organization that administers our housing voucher program, and they tried out this new online system for people to apply. They opened it up in September. They had about 230 vouchers available at the time. When they opened up the online application, 25,000 people in Franklin County applied for assistance. Now, maybe some of those aren't eligible, but
right.
the demand is enormous for assistance with helping people pay their rent.
Well, why is it so out of whack?
Well, we have a Congress that doesn't fund it. I mean, and we've had presidents that didn't fund it. It's really a bipartisan neglect at a policy level. So we have not funded expanded vouchers in very many ways, very much at all. When we've done it kind of experimentally with certain populations, we could see a dramatic improvement in the lives of people. For example, a few years ago, we made a bipartisan agreement that we should fund access to vouchers for homeless veterans. You know, it was sort of like if right. there's anybody that we could agree to help, it should be our veterans. It should be and people were living on the street. They'd served our country. So there was bipartisan agreement to do something about it. And lo and behold, when you target housing assistance to those veterans, homelessness among veterans has dramatically dropped.
Right.
And that's across the country. It's true in Ohio. Well, we ought to do the same for our families with children, our seniors, other people that are homeless or near homeless, or people that Matthew describes in his book that are paying 60-70% of their income for their housing costs. And this is caused by two sides of the same coin, which is housing costs have risen.
Mm-hmm.
Ohio is not an expensive housing state. But even here, it's risen dramatically.
There's a shortage.
Yeah,
rental housing.
It's a shortage of rental housing that's affordable.
Yeah,
we have housing stock. There's some communities that could probably use more housing stock, but the bigger problem is that housing isn't affordable. And secondly, the other side of the coin is our incomes have gone down. Even median household income in Ohio has dropped, and not just a little bit, but It's the shift from manufacturing jobs, more middle class incomes, to more service sector jobs. So you have people working sometimes multiple jobs, but still can't have enough to meet their housing costs. So those are two sides of the same coin. It's an income and an access to affordable housing problem.
You know, Matthew Desmond, I feel like there's this huge current going on underneath everything in our everyday lives of these people struggling like this. How does it? And your book, of course, goes a great distance to decipher and to describe what's going on. But why has it been so under the radar?
I think we focused a lot on jobs and a lot on other things that are related to inequality, things like mass incarceration or public policy reform. Those are all really important things to consider. But housing has to be at the top of the domestic agenda, too. And I think part of the reason that it's been a little under the radar is that it hasn't been as bad as it is today. You know, what we're seeing today is somewhat historically novel. You know, the fact that most poor renting families are giving most of what they have to housing isn't something we saw, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And so I think that we are in a new kind of era when it comes to the characteristics and nature of poverty in the U.S., and it means that we can't fix poverty without fixing housing.
We have an email from Terry who writes, I think there are many small landlords who are trying to keep rent low, but property tax has gone up faster in Columbus than income. The Columbus schools 3 years ago just added a significant increase. Water costs have increased greatly. A landlord has to pass those costs on. Property tax was $1,200 when the building was purchased. I assume this is a building that Terry owns. When the building was purchased, it is now $8,000. That is a big reason for rent increases.
Well, there's a lot of factors. I mean, landlords have hard costs. I mean, they do. And you can't really argue with that. Insurance costs have gone up. A lot of their costs have gone up. So, you know, you can't really fault landlords for setting their rents at a level to cover their costs, plus, you know, a reasonable profit. So
mm-hmm.
I don't argue with her point. The point is where the individuals can no longer afford to make the rent at 30% of their income or even 40% of their income. That's really where the public sector needs to step in and say we need to help fill that gap between what the cost of operating that housing is and what some of our low-income residents can afford to pay.
You know, Matthew Desmond, the landlord that we were talking about earlier in the program, Shireen,
mm-hmm.
she has to know that a lot of her tenants are set up for failure.
Shireen kind of sees herself as a charitable businesswoman. She didn't get into the business of landlording to be a social worker. She got into it to make a living, and she makes one. You know, she takes Jamaican vacations every year. She recently purchased a condo in Florida. She's expanded operations to other states. Her business is growing. The problem is, it's growing because she's taking money out of the pockets of the poor and directly contributing to their poverty. And I think we just have to have a conversation as a country about the fact that some people do make a living and some people, frankly, make a killing off the poor. Housing is too fundamental a human need. It's too central to human flourishing. It's too foundational to economic mobility to be considered just a commodity that cashes out. If we don't address that fact, we're going to be in a situation where housing costs are allowed to grow, and low-income families and their children really bear the burdens and the consequences of the fact that their lives are defined by giving most of their income to housing and being evicted when they, you know, inevitably fall behind.
Bill Faith, the housing meltdown, the mortgage meltdown, was particularly acute in Ohio. It was one of the first states to show
right.
a big problem. It's no coincidence that we have this rental problem and in the wake of the housing meltdown.
Well, the fact that we had so many evictions for so many years, put more pressure on the rental market.
Yeah.
So, you know, you had a lot more people competing for the units that were available. But I want to point out an interesting point that I think Matthew's book really helps to bring to life. And that is, you know, unlike the foreclosure spike hit during, you know, the biggest numbers we were getting every year were during the middle of the recession.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were getting up to 80, 90,000 foreclosure filings a year. Now that's dropped back down to a more, it's still historically higher than in the 90s. But it's like 40,000, 45,000 is where we're at now. Evictions, on the other hand, haven't dropped off at all. So you look at where they were during the middle of the recession, and you look at where they are today, and these are former court-filed evictions. These are not the informal or the illegal evictions that Matthew talks about in his book. These are actual court filings. And we've had – it's around 112,000 a year. Much greater than the foreclosure filings were at their peak, and it hasn't gone down since we've had some recovery.
And Matthew Desmond, I think you do a good job in the book of making the connection, explaining the cycle of the eviction issue, that it's not a result of poverty, it causes poverty.
That's right. So eviction causes loss. You lose not only your home, but also your possessions often, which are either piled on the streets or taken by movers to a storage unit. And families who are now homeless often can't keep up with the payments. The biggest moving company in Milwaukee that does evictions told me that 70% of their eviction moves just get thrown in the dump. Children lose their schools. You lose your neighbors. Eviction comes with a mark or a blemish, and a lot of landlords refuse to accept families that have recent eviction records,
mm-hmm.
and so do public housing authorities. So we're systematically denying public housing to families in most need of it.
Why do public housing authorities deny assistance to people who have been evicted? Do you understand that?
So public housing authorities are confronted with a list of thousands and sometimes tens of thousands of people long. And I think that they see themselves as having a responsibility of somehow winnowing down that list. And some of them use evictions as a strike against an applicant. So if all three of us were applying for public housing and I had a bunch of evictions and you didn't, you're on the list too, you know? So it's kind of a sense of a judgment. And I think that one thing that we just have to be careful about is kind of assuming that an eviction is a result of some sort of irresponsibility. If you're like a single mom, like Arlene, who I write about in the book a lot, and you're paying 80% of your income to live at the very bottom of the market, you know, eviction is much more of inevitability than irresponsibility. And I think we have to rewrite that story.
Bill Faith, what about that? What about the policies? They seem, well, antithetical in a way.
Well, if the resources were there to try to really work with people and serve people, then I don't think we'd see that as much. The fact of the matter is when CMHA has 25,000 people that have applied for assistance, wouldn't they look at some screening criteria for how they choose – how they do their tenant selection. But if they had assistance available for a much larger segment of people that are poor, then they would try to work with people and overcome some of the issues that they may face. I understand where the policy comes from.
It helps them make choices, hard choices.
Right. It's like if there's only room in the boat for four people and there's 10 people that need to get on the boat, who do you take first? You make some choices. And actually, Matthew talked about 1 in 4 that are eligible for federal housing assistance, mm-hmm. and those are rent subsidies or public housing, get it. So if you're entitled, there's really no entitlement. If you're eligible, all you're entitled to do in some places is get on a waiting list. In many places, they don't even maintain a waiting list anymore.
Matthew Desmond, where in the equation of this eviction problem can we flip a switch? Can we change a number that can start to turn something around quickly? Is it just a matter of having more money, having more vouchers, that kind of a thing?
I think we have to have a conversation as a nation around the question of, do we believe that access to affordable, decent housing is part of what it means to be an American? We've affirmed the right to decent education, provision in old age, because we've recognized that those things are fundamental to human flourishing. And it's impossible to argue that housing is not fundamental to living a healthy life and striving for economic mobility. I think we have to extend the right to shelter in this country. So how do we do that? What's the best way to do that? And I think the best way to do that is to take this program that's already working really well, the housing voucher program, and make it universal. Extend this program to all families below the poverty line. It would drastically, radically change the face of poverty in America today. And it would allow parents to invest in their children, in their communities, in themselves. And we are absolutely able to do this. We have the resources. We've just made decisions about how to spend the money. And I think that we should just be honest about that as a nation. If poverty persists in this wealthy nation, it's not for lack of money. We lack something else.
And Bill Faith, you've been having this conversation with lawmakers, at least at the state level, for as long as I've known you, 20 years. Has the conversation changed? Are we off topic now when it comes to housing issues?
Well, if our number one priority as a state government is to cut taxes, then it's going to be hard to do much about these kinds of problems. I do think that a lot of the responsibility falls at the federal level. I think states can help. I think local governments can help. But I think we're really talking about a national conversation and a matter of national policy. And, I remember, I've been at this a long time, as you said, I remember when we would argue with the feds about only committing 250,000 new vouchers to the program. But what's most common today is we commit no new vouchers to the program. So we're not even trying to expand the availability of housing subsidies for folks.
Bill Faith, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Bill Faith is the executive director of the Coalition on Homelessness and Housing in Ohio. The Coalition on Homelessness and Housing in Ohio's annual conference, Housing Ohio 2016, is occurring in April. And our other guest, Matthew Desmond, will be speaking at that. Matthew Desmond, thanks to you as well. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks for talking about this crucial issue.
Matthew Desmond, he's a Harvard sociologist and the author of the new book, Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. Thanks to the All Sides staff, Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Shyla Knott, All Sides interns Summer Cartwright, Khalid Moalim, and Sydney Schaefer, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DiCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.